Doctor Show.
You have all made it to the dance. You have all made it.
Coming to you from the X-Access, it's John of All Trades with your host, John X.
Welcome to the John of All Trades podcast, episode 39. I am your host, John X. Thank you for joining us. Glad to have you back once again. Hope you had a happy Thanksgiving. I myself had a lovely Thanksgiving. It was actually the first week we did not have an episode. I'm sure you noticed. I'm sure you thought, hey, where's my new episode? Well, it's this week because last week you were with your family. You were doing the holiday thing. And you're not going to be listening to my podcast, which brings me to a programming note. Wednesday, December 24th, Christmas Eve, there's going to be no episode. Wednesday, January 31st, also no episode. So we're going to be off for 2 weeks. January 31st, what the hell am I talking about? December 31st. So December 24th, December 31st, Christmas Eve, New Year's Eve, no new episodes. We'll be back in January. And I have a brand new series coming up for you in January. It's exciting. It's a four-part series. It's one of my favorite things in the world. We are going to be spotlighting a company that I absolutely adore. So stay tuned for that. I'll tell you more about that as we get closer. But Thanksgiving. Had a lovely Thanksgiving. Got together with family. Had my new daughter. Grace was just a delight. But, you know, anytime you have someone who is exactly a month old, which she was on Thanksgiving, she's going to be the hit of the party. She's adorable. She's a baby. People want to hold the baby. Even the 11-year-old. We have a photo of him holding the baby, and it was one of the most adorable things I'd ever seen. When I was 11, there's no way in hell you could have gotten me to hold a baby. This young gentleman at the party, he was all over it. So, fantastic. More power to him. As you were at Thanksgiving, one of the things that typically happens is people go around and say what they're thankful for. Not to be cheesy about this, not to be hacky or cliche or anything. One of the things I'm thankful for is this week's guest, and it's Sherry Schenck. Sherry Schenck is the founder of the Rocky Mountain Children's Law Center. You can find them at RockyMountainChildrensLawCenter.org. Spell all those words out. It's all together. RockyMountainChildrensLawCenter.org. And what do? Basically, they provide compassionate legal counsel, education, and public policy reform on behalf of abused, neglected, and foster kids. They work with kids who have fallen through the cracks of the system. Now, we all know that we have a social safety net, and the social safety net, no matter how you feel about it politically, exists, and it exists for the benefit of those who cannot take care of themselves. Chief among them, children. And so the Rocky Mountain Children's Law Center works to ensure that these kids get taken care of and that they have advocates. This is something Sherry has done for over 30 years. In the early 80s, she founded the Law Center, and she tells this story on the podcast. After seeing a court case in which there was a young boy, he was disabled, he had a club foot, he was blind, and he had really thrived with some foster parents, the judge ruled that that was impeding progress to go back to his parents. Now, this is an insane decision on a number of levels, and I'm not going to step on the episode because Sherry tells the story just extraordinarily eloquently, and it sort of informs her overall, the way that she works, the things that she wants to achieve. When she started, it's like anything else. She didn't have any great grand designs on creating this long-lasting sort of legacy for herself. She just saw a need in the system and addressed it. And she is just a beautiful, beautiful, wonderful person. And it was a privilege to get to sit down with her. She told me, in 33 years of doing this work, she had never done a long-form interview like this, so this was really a unique opportunity. She was formerly the executive director at the Children's Law Center, but now she is and always will be the founder. She's moved on doing some other things. She's passed off the executive director role, and the Law Center continues to thrive. It's a great organization. The company I work with in my day job does a lot of work with them. We sort of allude to that. That's how I actually got hooked up with Sherry. And Sherry talks about being in the encore of her career, which is a neat turn of phrase and one that I really liked. So we talk more about that. Also of note, this episode airs on December 3rd. This is when it debuts. It's Sherry's birthday. So that was serendipitous. I had no plans on that, but we were talking about it. She said, when's this going to air? And I said, December 3rd. She said, that's my birthday, which was shocking to me. This episode is one that I am particularly proud of. I mean, I'm proud of all of them, but I think what you'll see is Sherry is just an absolute ray of sunshine. There is a lot of room to be sort of grim and sort of dour and down about some of the issues. I mean, she's seen some really horrible things in terms of the work that she's done, but she is one of the most relentlessly upbeat and positive people I have ever had the pleasure of working with, and that comes through. So we talk about serious subject, but this episode is not a downer. This episode is very inspiring, very enlightening, very enlivening, invigorating. That's enough sort of adjectives here to describe it. Let's get to it. Episode 39, the John of All Trades podcast features Sherry Schenck, the founder of the Rocky Mountain Children's Law Center, and it begins right now.
I'm really good at digressing.
Yeah, I've worked with you before, so I'm familiar.
Sherry, what are you up to this weekend?
Well, this weekend I'm cleaning my house because I'm getting guests for Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah? Who's coming into town?
Oh, my gosh. A friend of mine from Austin is coming with her adopted daughter.
Nice.
A friend of mine that used to work with me at the Children's Law Center is coming from Washington, D.C.
Who is that?
Holly Barnes, who used to run our Dandelion Project.
Right, okay.
And a couple of young people, former foster kids, who I've traveled with across the country.
Nice.
They're coming, and one of them is bringing his girlfriend and then a long-term friend of mine. So I'm somebody who's never cooked a Thanksgiving turkey, and I'm having 10 people at my house for Thanksgiving.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Your family, you must count as your family. It must be an exceptionally large net, given the work that you've done.
Yeah. You know, sometimes I've shared my regret that I never had my own children, and people remind me every single day that I've had thousands of them.
Right.
And I think in terms of the work I've done, it's been both a calling and a blessing to have had all of those young people and everybody else that comes with them, you know,
yeah.
Whether it's the, you know, professionals involved or the experts or the families. It's wonderful.
Absolutely. So we're sitting here talking to Sherry Schenck down here in my basement. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, John. This is great.
Yeah, we got to know each other about 4 years ago, and I don't really talk about my day job here, but through my day job, you reached out to us, and our company was very involved in the work that you were doing at the time, that you were the executive director and founder of, right?
That's right.
And is that the correct title? Executive
yes.
director?
Well, I'm not the executive director anymore.
Right. But you were executive director and are and always will be the founder of the Rocky Mountain Children's Law Center. And so tell us a little bit about that. What does the Rocky Mountain Children's Law Center do?
Wow. You know, it's been such an incredible journey. I was recruited to come to Colorado to run a federal demonstration project and just assumed that I'd go back home afterwards. And
what is a federal demonstration project?
Where the federal government decides that, you know, some new idea should be tested. And so they identify a few places in the country that can test the same idea and offer kind of research information.
Okay,
in
great.
A sense. And so, you know, I was recruited to create and then to evaluate a couple of different models of providing legal services for abused and neglected children.
Okay.
So I came out here, and because of my previous experience with the Kemp Center and other experts in Colorado, I thought I was moving to the Mecca. And
right.
so I came out for a couple of years to run this federal demonstration project and thought I would go back home. And
where's home?
Home is Pittsburgh, or 30 miles from Pittsburgh. I grew up in the country.
Okay. So you grew up western Pennsylvania then?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Fantastic.
Yeah. And so when I got to Colorado, I realized that my work for the same population, abused and neglected children in Pittsburgh, had really kind of progressed light years ahead of what I was experiencing in Colorado. And what kept me here for sure was the lifestyle and the
right.
sunshine. I mean, nobody leaves the sunshine when they experience it as much as you do here in Colorado. But I was in a courtroom one day, and
when was this approximately?
Oh, gosh, this is the early 80s.
Okay, great.
So I had been running this project for a couple of years. My plan was to go back home, and I'm sitting in the back of a courtroom. I'm not involved in any way other than to observe.
Mm-hmm.
And the case that the judge is deciding is about a little 2.5-year-old boy. And this is a little boy who had been removed from his parents about 6 months of age and had thrived in the home of this foster family for 2 years.
Right.
And he was doing great. He was blind and he had a club foot and he had a lot of developmental difficulties, but he was thriving because of the love and care he received.
Yeah.
And then out of nowhere, this judge decided that this relationship that this little boy had with this couple was interfering with the Department of Social Services' ability to reunite him with his birth parents.
Okay, yeah, okay.
So if you were sitting in that courtroom, you would have known, just like I learned, that there was no way these parents could raise this child. They had IQs of 50. They were incapable of caring for themselves.
Right.
They couldn't care for any child, let alone a child with special needs. But the judge ordered the removal of this little boy and placed him with a strange family, placed him with another foster family.
Wait, why?
Because he thought that the relationship that this little boy, the wonderfully loving relationship that this little boy had developed over 2 years with this foster family, was interfering with the reunification plan. And I have to tell you, John, I was shocked. I mean, I'm a lawyer. I had no role in the case, but I could not believe that nobody spoke up.
Yeah.
The attorney for the child didn't speak up. The caseworker didn't speak up. The parent's attorney didn't speak up. And to this day,
yeah,
and it's now 30 years later, I still regret that I didn't stand up and scream and yell and shout and say,
right,
you know, please do not do this. But I walked out of that courtroom and I said, I'm starting my own organization and it's going to be about justice for kids.
Yeah. Well, I mean, listening to this, you wonder where sort of, I mean, I understand sort of in a legal sense, it's probably preferable to, all things being equal, right? You'd want to reunite a child with his birth parents. In the abstract, I get that. But where is the common sense principle here? You know, where you're seeing this and taking all the evidence, I'm struggling and I see why you started this organization.
Yeah, I continue to struggle with what happens. Now, I would like to believe that that would never happen again. It's now, many years later. But there are often times when I ponder where the common sense is.
Yeah.
And I think child abuse and neglect and the systems that are in place to address it have become so complex that we assume that we need formulas as a system, or that we have to really, you know, have these kind of boilerplate approaches to handling things, that we've often lost all common sense, and we don't think about the individual needs of individual children and families in the way that I believe we should.
Right, right.
And so lots of things happen to kids. For example, if you read a story in the newspaper about a horrible abuse incident, you want to believe, and that the child was removed, you want to believe that good things are going to happen to that child in the future. And sometimes that happens.
Yeah.
But sometimes what that child experiences in foster care, or just by being a ward of the state and in the system, is sometimes as bad as what we removed them from. So,
Wow.
You know, for example, I travel the country with two former foster kids. They're now 19 and 21, brother and sister. The brother was moved 24 times in foster care, and his sister was moved 12 times in foster
care. Have I met these kids? When we did the Our Kids, Your Kids rally, or the Your Kids, Our Kids rally?
Yes!
Were they the ones who spoke?
They were.
They are fantastic.
Aren't they?
Yeah. What are their names again?
They don't mind because they speak nationally.
They're like public advocates.
Letitia and Adrian.
That's right. Okay.
Yes. And they are incredible. As a matter of fact, Letitia and I are going to San Francisco on December the 1st because on December the 2nd, we're going to be speaking at a children's summit. And we're really looking at ways to engage young people who have experienced the foster care system to really speak about reform, because nobody tells a story like the one that lived it.
Well, no. I mean, first person account of, hey, this was my life. This is not just statistics. This is not off the page. Yeah. I am a living, breathing person who went through this, this, and this.
Exactly. And you know, you asked about common sense.
Yeah.
I want to share just a piece of Adrian's story.
Okay.
So Adrian moved 24 times between and among placements, foster homes. When he was 11, he was in the middle of a little league game. He was a good baseball player. He loved baseball. It was one of the few times he could feel normal. He could feel like he was just a regular kid, and he was with other regular kids, and they were playing baseball.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was on second base in the middle of a ball game, and a caseworker and a police officer took him off of second base to move him to another foster home.
Oh, my God. Just in the middle of the game, in the middle,
middle
of an inning.
Of the game.
While he is on base.
Right.
Did they pull him off base?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, we all know that social services is under-resourced.
Yeah.
And there's so much more that these kids need that just isn't available to them.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't take a nickel to make a decision about a placement change.
Yeah.
In a more humane, in a more thoughtful, in a more sensitive and loving way.
Yeah.
Than to interfere with something that allows a child to escape for just a minute.
Yeah.
Into a more normal world. Yeah. So there are a lot of things in the system. Now, the system has improved dramatically over the last 30 years, and thank God it has.
Sure.
And everybody works really hard, and there are no evil intentions.
I mean,
the thing of it is, everybody in the system does care. And so what infuriates me when I learn about the kinds of things that kids experience yeah. is that it shouldn't be that way.
Right.
You know, we all can make it better and different, but we have to create a critical mass of people who make it sort of the political will of the day that
yeah.
everybody needs to care enough to make changes.
Yeah. That's really elegantly stated. And I'm curious as to, you know, you mentioned social services is understaffed. You know, what are some of the challenges as we approach foster care and kids who are in the system? What are some of the things that are the challenges, and what can we do to address them?
Yeah. I think the greatest challenge is a lack of awareness or a lack of understanding.
Okay.
Again, I think that, you know, we tend to rely on assumptions in the world when we don't have all of the information. And
right.
so we want to assume good things happen to kids. We want to assume that everybody cares about kids. And we want to assume that somebody else is taking care of the problem.
Yeah.
And so I think the first thing is for everybody to learn about what's happening to kids. You know, talk to your legislators. Talk to anybody you know in your circle of friends who's a social worker or, you know, even in the school social workers or school teachers for that matter. But learn about what's happening to kids in our community, because what's happening to kids is not just affecting those kids and those families. It affects all of their future relationships. It affects their community. It affects each and every one of us. And we need to make it our business.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. We need to know what's happening. And then we need to figure out a way that we can help and reach out and do that. And we can help in small ways and large ways. And frankly, when anybody's come to me over the years and said, I'd really like to volunteer, I'd like to do something, my first question is always, what do you want to do?
Yeah.
What do you like to do? What skills or talents do you have? What would you enjoy?
Right.
How would you most like to help a child? So, for example, if you want to do something at arm's length, you can celebrate a foster youth's birthday. You could make resources available for school books or school clothes. You could offer your home for a Thanksgiving dinner. You could be a mentor. You could be a foster parent. You could be a CASA volunteer. There are a lot of volunteer roles in the system that allow you to do any number of things. What I would like to do is mobilize empty nesters. I would like to find all those people out there that have raised healthy, happy kids, and their kids are off to college now, or maybe their kids have gotten married, and see if I can mobilize those people to, you know, to be mentors, to help a young person get a job, to help a young person get into school, to pay for a semester of college. I mean, who knows what somebody
right,
might be willing
yeah.
to do. So there are so many things that they could do. And
so we're just underutilizing, I'd call it the collective will and energy and effort of the people.
Right.
Is that a way of characterizing it?
I think that's an excellent way to characterize it. And until we can mobilize and create momentum among, you know, the community in the biggest, broadest sense, you know, the system talks a lot about, you know, child abuse is not just a social services problem.
Yeah.
And I think generally the public agrees that it's not just a social services problem.
Right.
But we don't have a real engaged community. I mean, we have lots of foster parents who devote their lives to kids. We have different people at different times doing different things. So there is activity. but there isn't the kind of groundswell and the kind of momentum mm-hmm. that's going to force, you know, legislators in this state to right. really make the resources available that
systemic
are necessary.
Systemic change.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting you should mention systemic change because, you know, one of the things we talk about a lot is to change public policy or to create new public policy.
Yeah.
Well, what you learn when you're in the system is you can spend a couple of years and get a great piece of legislation passed, but it may or may not be implemented or enforced.
Hmm.
And so unless you have people actually enforcing
right.
that new law that was just passed, it may or may not make a difference in the lives of kids. Wow. It's kind of like you, John, you know, when you go through a red light at 3 o'clock in the morning
right.
and there's no cop, so you don't get a ticket. You know,
right.
If somebody's
that's
not,
a good point.
If somebody's not fighting to enforce the laws that are on the books, then kids may be denied the services that they're entitled to.
Wow. Yeah. Tough problem to address too, because I mean, yeah, you come up with the idea, but if there's no follow through, then the idea may as well not have existed.
Yes. And it is tough to enforce. It's tough to enforce even when you're a lawyer for a child in a courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you what, some really egregious things happened with a family within the last couple of years. And an adoptive family basically took in three very, very troubled, very, very abused, horribly abused kids and really fought hard to get the information and the resources and really didn't get what they needed to care for these kids and filed a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty rare, actually, and perhaps appropriately rare.
Right.
But the appellate court was so shocked at basically the facts and what happened in that case that basically the parties settled for $6.2 million
uh-huh.
award to those children. All of the money went to those children. And the
wow.
day that the adoptive family got those funds was the day that adoptive father got in his car and drove one of the three kids that he adopted, drove him to the best treatment facility in the nation.
Yeah.
And got him the best care, the best treatment. And actually, that young man graduated from high school this year.
Wow.
Which was really, both a surprise and a delight. But it's really unspeakable sometimes
yeah.
what kids experience. And
that, that's,
and we all need to be vigilant, all of us.
Yeah.
You know, everybody.
No, I mean, that's an absolutely staggering story. I'm curious. I want to go back a little bit to, you're in the courtroom, right? With this poor, you know, special needs child and taken away from the foster family that, you know, they had grown a great bond together and seemed to be thriving. You decided you were going to start your own foundation. You were going to start your own thing to address some of these problems.
Right.
So take me through how that got started and what became the Rocky Mountain Children's Law Center.
Wow. You know, I cannot claim to have had some grand plan in my head when I did that.
Very few people do, but that's how, you know, you just start doing the right thing, right? And just start
exactly.
pushing, right?
Well, and basically, I have been really lucky over 30 years. I have had so many people that have been willing to offer their time and their talent, including you, John.
Right.
You and, you know, your company and so many others. So anyway, along the way, I've just, you know, you reach out for help and you have to be willing to reach out for help, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you do, you find people that are willing to do things. So somebody did all of the, you know, sort of administrative stuff to starting a 501c3 nonprofit organization.
Right.
And I needed a board of directors. And so I reached out to people I knew, some of whom were involved with the organization when I was doing the federal demonstration study. And so I got them and got others. And then just, you know, one step at a time, our first office was, you know, in the basement of a Victorian home in Capitol Hill, but we had 1.5 rooms in a basement.
No kidding.
And then we moved around. We moved downtown in the days when downtown wasn't necessarily the most attractive place to go.
Right. And pre-Coors Field days.
Yeah. And at 5 o'clock, you know, the city was kind of dead.
Right.
And so, But we had a law firm that moved out of one of the floors in the Women's Bank building, and they gave us free rent. And so we had their lease for, I don't know, almost a year or two. And then that was extended and extended. And, you know, and then we had offices at the law school when it was over at 20th and Quebec. And so we moved around a lot, and but got free space. And somebody always donated, you know, equipment, computer equipment or fax machines or yellow tablets. And you just move forward. And
so you're basically just cobbling this together.
Cobbled it together in those early days and had really good people with me. And then Maha United Way was probably, you know, the first to really jump in and give us the kind of support that was long lasting. And so probably for, gosh, all but the first couple of years of our existence, United Way has always been there. And it was, for 20 years, it was the only funding that we knew we could get consistently year to year. Other than that, it was reaching out to other foundations and corporations and individuals. And, you know, and we have some major donors that have funded us for like 25 years. And it's a beautiful thing, because not only do they support your cause, but anytime you share your passion with somebody in that intense way where they're giving their money and their support and their time, they become your friends.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I want to remember their birthdays. I want to celebrate the holidays with them, you know.
Well, Sherry, you used to call me. It was always my favorite call when I'd get a voicemail from you, because it would start, you'd usually start by singing. And it was always, I'd click my voicemails because I could listen to them through the computer. I go, Sherry's calling me. It's going to be a good day.
Well, you know, it's so funny. I have a friend who has a beautiful, beautiful voice, and I'm almost embarrassed to sing to her, but it's become kind of my standard because, you know, I've learned over the years, like sometimes I call people early in the morning. I'll never forget the time that I called this business leader. I called him at 5 a.m. because I thought I was calling his office number, and I figured it would ring into voicemail and I would leave a message.
Okay.
And I had to get it start on the day, you know, so usually I start pretty early. Well, I messed up and I actually dialed his home number, which I just happened to have, and woke him up at 5 a.m. And I was so shocked that he answered, and you could tell that he had been sleeping. And so I started singing, you know. And nobody can really be upset with you when you're singing to them on the phone. And so even if you don't have a good voice. And I don't claim to have a good voice at all. Like I said, when my friend who has a really good voice, when I sing to her, I'm almost embarrassed. But it's just kind of a way to, you know, I don't know, jog them into thinking differently. Well, whatever they might have been thinking before I called, they're all of a sudden going to think differently.
Well, it's so different than the vast majority of the voicemails you get. Because, you know, they can be sort of, hey, this is Bob from the chamber. Just wanted to check on your membership dues. And you're going, ugh. Like, why? Like, do I really want to call this person back? Whereas you get such energy and such happiness and such positivity from you. You're like, I'm calling Sherry back. Sherry's my first call back.
And, that's like, great.
That makes you feel good.
That's great.
And one of the things I wanted to remark on, and this will lead into a question, is it was always so nice to get a message like that, because I imagine with some of the things that you do and some of the cases that you've seen, it can be fairly grim, just given some of the situations of the kids that you deal with. So I'm curious, even from the early days of when you started this, what types of work were you doing? How did you get involved? Because you said you wanted to get involved and you wanted to make sure that that never happened again, what happened to that poor blind child. So how did the work start to take shape? And what types of things were you doing then?
Wow. Well, initially, it was actually representing individual children that had been removed from their families because of abuse or neglect in that court process. Because I knew that if I had been standing up for that 2.5-year-old child, he would not have been moved.
Right.
Now,
right.
I suppose that judge could have ignored everything I said and ignored common sense and ignored everything else and still done it. But
sure, it seems unlikely, but.
But everybody was silent in that courtroom that day. And to me, that's just unconscionable.
Was it just like a public defender there, or
a court-appointed attorney?
Okay, yeah.
For the parents, a court-appointed attorney for the child.
Okay,
and 30
you.
Years ago, the quality of legal representation for children was really poor. Some lawyers didn't even show up in court. Some showed up and didn't speak, you know, and some obviously did a good job, but it was dramatically different than it is today.
Good Lord, why even have a lawyer then?
Well, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly. And so, so initially, probably for the first 10 years, for the most part, we represented kids in court. We gave speeches in the community. We tried to get, you know, service organizations like the Lions Club and the Optimist Club and those folks to understand the importance of the work that we did.
How did you find these kids?
Well, we got court appointed. We were court appointed.
Okay.
Because
I get you.
State of Colorado, and actually that raises an important thing to probably let your audience know. And that is that, you know, in Colorado and in many other states across the country, lawyers are appointed for children. In Colorado, they're called guardians ad litem.
Okay.
And our job is to look out for the best interest of a child.
Gotcha.
So for 10 years, that was really the focus of our work. And of course, we had to raise money, you know, to keep a nonprofit going. And so, you know, that was much of what we did. And then as time goes on, you realize that you can change the life of every child that you represent in the courtroom, but you know, there are thousands of kids in foster care.
Yeah.
And to have an impact on those other kids that you might not represent, you know, you need to get involved in policy change, and you need to get involved with the legislature, and you got to train, and you got to do any number of things. And so we began training foster parents, and we began a clinical program at the University of Denver Sturm College of Law. It wasn't called Sturm College then, but it was the university, the law school. And, you know, began to just do other things. We started a therapeutic gardening program called the Dandelion Project for our clients. And for a while, we had a canine-assisted therapy program where a young woman graduated with a degree in that field and engaged her dog with our clients. And John, as a cat lover, you know, or any animal lover, know the impact of animals, you know.
Oh, yeah. They'll brighten your whole day.
That's right. They'll brighten our day. They'll brighten that of children. They'll brighten that of all kinds of populations out there, senior citizens, prison populations. We know a lot about that. And they made, those programs made, you know, an incredible difference. And so every time we took a step, we knew there was something else we needed to do. Yeah. And we did it. And we did it on faith.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't like there was a pot of money sitting there to say, okay, who are you going to hire to do this job or that job?
Yeah.
You know, you just took a leap of faith. And you had to take risks because nothing was easy in this field.
No.
You know, but gosh, when you look at the lives of these kids, no matter what you have to do, no matter what you have to risk or sacrifice or, well, I guess those are the, you know,
right.
Risk or sacrifice. You were willing to do it because, you know, whatever you had to do as an adult was going to always be easier than what these kids experienced.
Right. Well, it's almost like you can't, like, failure is not an option.
That's right.
I mean,
that's exactly right. Thank you for saying that.
Right. I mean, you know, you said, okay, well, as we continue to get deeper into this work, you identify needs and you say, okay, these are community needs. We cannot fail. Let's push forward. It will happen. We believe it will happen. That's the type of attitude you had to have, right?
That's exactly right.
Right.
And, you know, I've been speaking pretty positively and optimistically about just do it. Just do it. You know, it's always going to work out. And perhaps it's important to share, you know, kind of a major obstacle, you know, as we moved forward. And, so there was a point in our history. Well, first of all, the state contribution to the, you know, or the state compensation rate for lawyers who represented children was always pretty low.
Yeah, sure.
You know, 30 years ago, it was like $100 a case. Then it maybe became 200.
Gosh.
And, you know, it didn't matter how many kids were involved in the case. You know, then it became $500 a case, no matter how many kids. And then eventually it kept growing. And so at the point that I'm going to mention, it was about $1,000 a case. And then you could ask the court for excess fees.
Sure.
You know, if you needed them. But the bottom line is there's never been any real value placed on that work such that it was compensated in the same way that lawyers are compensated for other kinds of practice. And so
you're not going to get the same kind of money doing corporate litigation as you are for representing abused and foster kids, right?
And the people that go into this work don't expect it, don't want it. It's not not an issue that drives them.
It's not where the screw turns for them, sure.
I like that. That's right. But what made our situation difficult at a time when my husband and, you know, in all the years I ran the law center, I was married for only 4 short years.
Okay.
So, but it was during that time period, which was, I think, the early 2000s, that my husband got very ill, and so I was taking some time off in order to care for him because he had only so many months to live.
Sure.
And so The bottom line is that for the couple of months that I was kind of AWOL, I really wasn't able to raise funds for the Law Center.
Okay.
And the Law Center got into some significant trouble. And so when I came back to the organization, and I had only been, I had never been totally gone, but when I came totally back, basically, you know, there was at least one board member who had some real concerns about the financial viability of the organization.
Sure.
And so I said, you know, I said, well, I said a lot of things, but the important thing was I made a commitment to the board that I would do whatever it took.
Mm-hmm.
And what it took was raising $400,000 in 4 months.
Oh my God.
In order to make the end of the year budget. And so I mortgaged my house.
You mortgaged your own house?
I mortgaged my house so that I could cover payroll, and I did whatever it took. And right. The reason I share that is not for some pat on the back.
Right.
But just the drive and the belief that if that organization went under, so did, not only did all of the adults who worked and devoted their lives to this mm-hmm. cause, but obviously all the kids that we had been serving would
yeah.
not be served by us. They might be served by somebody else.
Right.
But
who wouldn't be quite as good?
In our view, in my view, that
yeah.
that would be true. And so, anyway, all it took was knowing that. And I had never raised that much money in that short a period of time ever in the history of my organization.
Well,
but
who,
I did
who
it.
Has?
I did it, and I did it because a lot of people came forward. And so not only did we overcome that obstacle, but then it was almost like manna from heaven. It was like this
right.
miracle that occurred. And so, you know, a short time after kind of recovering from that, we had an anonymous $1 million donor.
Wow.
And then a short time after that, basically, the state decided to change the way it compensated lawyers, and instead of it being a per case situation, it was a per hour situation, a low hourly rate, but nonetheless an hourly rate,
sure.
which meant that if you put in a lot of time, which we always did for our clients,
yeah.
we would, our budget would get more state money than it ever had, because it
yeah.
was always such a small portion of our budget.
Yeah, a pittance.
Exactly. And so, When those three things happened kind of all at the same time, all of a sudden we were flying.
Yeah.
I mean, all of a sudden, you know, we would never have to face that kind of struggle again. We were on strong financial footing. You know, we grew and grew and grew. And then in 2010, the state made another giant change, which benefited the work that we do and our organization. And so,
and what was that?
We're off and running. Well, in 2010, decided the Office of the Child's Representative, which is actually an organization that we helped to create.
Okay.
Back in, I think 2000, they came to a decision that they wanted to support specialized offices that base multidisciplinary offices, they call them, where you have partnerships between lawyers and social workers to do this work. And we became one that was chosen to represent, you know, a large bulk of the cases, you know, in Denver. And that's been true for now several years. And I think, you know, this is an organization that will last for a lifetime, which is certainly
so.
My goal.
Yeah. Well, and again, you know, what strikes me though is you didn't set out to like create a legacy for yourself or I'm going to build this and it's going to become this. It's just, okay, this happened. I need to help. What can I do right now? And then it grows from there.
Right.
And I think when it comes to anything, and one of the things I've learned in doing this podcast and interviewing so many different people from so many different backgrounds is that's sort of the nexus for everyone. No one knows what it's going to become, including this. I mean, I just had to start interviewing people. I was dragging my feet forever. And this is an internet radio show. So, you know, I don't have kids at risk or anything, but you know, there's still such a hesitancy to take that first step in creating something.
Yeah.
And the trick is really just to do it. And once you're doing it, then you're just kind of doing it, and then it grows in whatever way it's going to grow.
Right.
So hearing you describe that, I mean, I'm struck by that because the work that you do is so inspiring. And I've been privileged enough to, you know, to get to work with you in a lot of different types of projects that hearing the humble sort of origins of it is just inspiring in a whole new way.
So, thanks, John.
Yeah,
I appreciate
of course.
That.
Another thing I'm curious about is, so you obviously got your law degree.
Yes.
Where did you go?
Rutgers University.
Okay, Rutgers. And how did you sort of decide that this was going to be your path in law? Because obviously a lot of different directions you can go.
Yeah.
How did you arrive at this one?
Well, it's interesting. When I went to law school, the only thing I knew is that I wanted more power to make a difference. I took a year off between college and law school and was a, I directed a...
Where'd you get your undergrad?
The University of Pittsburgh.
Okay.
So I ran a daycare center for children, poor children of single mothers. Those were the days of the Office of Economic Opportunity.
Okay.
Long time ago. And so I ran a daycare center and I had all these beautiful children in my daycare center right. that I delighted in teaching to dance and have art projects and go on these field trips and do all these wonderful things. And one day there was this moment that I said to myself, you know, when these kids go home at the end of the day, what opportunities do they face? Are they going to be educated? Are they going to get their high school degree or be able to go to college? And I felt that it was not obvious and it was not likely. And I wanted to do something for this population called kids. And I didn't have any idea about abused kids or neglected kids. And I'm not even suggesting that they were those kids.
Right, right.
But
they were just kids as far as you were concerned.
They were just kids. And so I went to law school to try to gain some maybe sense of power or prestige to do some kind of a job somewhere and make a difference.
Okay.
And then went to law school. There was one class in juvenile law. That's it. In the 3 years of law school, I had one class. And then I thought, well, I guess I'll work at Neighborhood Legal Services in Pittsburgh. You know, that's a legal aid office for poor people, and I'll do civil litigation, and that's what I'll do. Well, at the interview, I met Tony Wettick, who is now a judge, has been for many, many years, but was the director of legal aid, or legal services, and has been a judge for a long time now. And he told me about this child advocacy division, which he created just a couple of years earlier, and that was a part of legal services. And I, of course, said, oh my gosh, that's what I want to do. And he, you know, tempered my enthusiasm and said, you know, it might be good to get some experience under your belt before you, you know, develop a specialty. So, I did. And then a couple of years later, I went into the child advocacy unit. I got a fellowship to come to Colorado and learn for 6 months at the Kemp Center all about abused and neglected kids. Went back to Pittsburgh, ran the office for a couple more years, and then was recruited to come out here. So it was, not like there was this really well-developed legal field at time, but it was certainly a beginning field. And, it was called Pediatric Law by some folks in Denver. And I think, frankly, you know, the Children's Law Center is really responsible for really creating this specialized, or at least leading the charge, or participating in the leadership of a charge to really look at quality legal services for kids and really making their lives better by virtue of the systems intervention and really creating this field that we all now know to be, you know, child advocacy.
Well, one of the things I'm curious about is you said you there was one class that you took that was in this field. Is part of your work to try and extend into academia and get people interested in this? Do you network in that way and try and develop curriculum that addresses this need?
Absolutely. And in fact, in the early 90s, we started a clinical program at the University of Denver Law School, and it continues to this day. And that was our whole point. I mean, we went to the faculty and we said, you know, we'd like to develop a clinical program where law students get to learn not only the law and how to be lawyers, but also how to represent, you know, children in a courtroom under our supervision. And, you know, I was a little more enthusiastic than perhaps the faculty at the moment. And they said, well, why don't you get your foot in the door? Why don't you teach a class first and then figure, you know, and then we'll figure it out. So that's exactly what we did. We taught a class. It was wonderfully popular. Everybody loved it. And eventually it became a clinical program. And now it's not quite 20 years old early 90s. Pretty soon it'll be like 20 years old. So, and so we have, you know, both inspired and trained, you know, law students who have become not only, you know, lawyers, but judges and, you know,
and who are versed at least somewhat in the issues of this.
Absolutely.
Okay. So yeah, it's another sort of arm of raising awareness.
Yes.
Just throughout the system in terms of government, the public, and then throughout the legal profession itself.
That's exactly right.
Wow. That is amazing.
Yeah.
So one of the things that you mentioned, and I can't remember if you mentioned it when we had the mics on or not, but we talked about it a little bit upstairs, is you're no longer executive director, the Rocky Mountain Children's Law Center, but you're still involved in this work quite extensively. Yes. I like the way you put it. You said you're in the encore of your career.
Right.
So tell me a little bit about what you're doing now and how is it different from being executive director?
Well, as the executive director, I guess when you're a founder of an organization, and I'm sure this is true in business as well as in nonprofits, when you found an organization, you start out doing everything.
Yeah.
You know, so I was a lawyer and I would represent kids and then I would be a fundraiser and then I would write grants and then I would go give speeches and then I would train foster parents. And so you kind of do it all. And if you do it all for a really long time, you get to a place where you realize that you're doing less and less of the things that really matter to you and the things that really, that are heartfelt, you know.
That energize you.
I mean, walking out of a courtroom knowing that you changed the life of a child, I mean, there's nothing like it. I mean, you are 4 feet off the ground and, you know, nobody could, I mean.
I can't imagine.
It's just unbelievable. And so I was at a point in my career that I thought that, first of all, I think the Law Center was at a point where it was financially solid and I would feel very comfortable turning it over to a successor.
Yeah.
But for me personally, I really wanted to spend more of my time and talent really focused on the kids and really trying to make big, bold changes, if I could, you know, not only locally, but nationally. And so I left with the vision that I was going to mobilize this army of former foster kids because, they could be the voice for change and nobody tells a story like the one that lived it.
Yeah.
And so if I could mobilize kids, then that I think I could sort of move the needle on change. And I had no idea how to do that. And, I had no idea the first step. I just knew that I need to be freed, you know, from the other responsibilities before I could do it. And so.
Important work, but time consuming work, right?
Yes, exactly. Absolutely. I mean, critical work for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I have now, you know, for the last 3 years, I have traveled around with these two kids who actually were never my clients or the clients of the Law Center. But over the last several years, I've traveled with other clients other kids who were clients of the Law Center. And so, as I've watched these young people speak to audiences like the leadership of the American Bar Association, 350 of them sitting in an audience and then asking questions like you asked, like, where's the common sense?
Yeah.
And how could somebody do that? And I don't understand why that happened. And why, you know, didn't you have a lawyer to change that? And why this or why that?
Yeah.
And so I'm moving in directions now where I'm meeting people that are engaged with these kids. And I'm going to be a part of that team. It's a national team of people that care about the same thing I care about. And so on December the 2nd, I'm going to be in San Francisco with this young woman that I told you about that grew up in foster care. And it's going to be a national summit. It's going to be a national coming together of young people from across this country. And, you know, who knows what might happen as a result of this new initiative, if you would.
Yeah. So you have this vision of traveling the country with this army of foster kids to enact change. What's next in that journey beyond San Francisco? Do you have a sense for that? Or I guess you said, who knows what's possible, right?
Well, you know, I have a sense in that there are lots of these kids. Some states around the country have formalized groups of former foster kids. For example, in Colorado, there's a Bridging the Gap program through Maha United Way, and there's a Legacy Project in Arapahoe County that, you know, kind of engages these kids. And so there are pockets of kids. I think what's missing is figuring out how to mobilize their passion, their energy, and their focus so that we can create a national agenda. Now, this meeting in San Francisco is actually a partnership between Baker & McKenzie, which is the biggest law firm in the country with offices in lots of places, not Colorado, but lots of places not only in the country but the world, and Google.
Wow.
So if, wow. if we can partner with Google and get Google interested in trying to help connect young people across this nation with one another so that if, for example, you know, Colorado wants to press for some new legislation, you know, that California's already, you know, gotten passed by, you know, engaging former foster youth in the process, you know, then everybody can communicate with one another no matter where they live.
Yeah. That sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
In your time doing this, you've done this for over 30 years now. What is something that has surprised you about doing this work?
That's a good question, but I know the answer because I struggle with why it is so hard. Why it's so hard to help children.
Yeah.
I thought, as a lawyer, I wore a white hat. I was like one of the good guys. I was like fighting for kids. Nobody could fault me.
Yeah.
Well, let me tell you. In the first 10 years I was in Colorado, I don't think I could count, you know, anybody in the courtroom who ever liked me, let alone, you know.
Why is that?
I think partly because I've always wanted to speak directly and honestly. I learned very early in my career that I could not be critical, because when you're critical, then the conversation just goes in a different direction. And I don't mean to be critical.
Right.
But what I've figured out is, if you focus on the children, I mean, I always say, lots of good people in the system, everybody cares about kids. So then why are bad things happening to kids?
Yeah.
Well, it's because, despite everybody's good intentions, kids are being harmed. And so I want to speak directly and boldly about the harms, and that makes people uncomfortable.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's like, you know, it's so funny. If you were another attorney in the courtroom, and every time I saw you, I would be talking about all the horrible things that are happening to kids, you know, you wouldn't really want to talk to me, and certainly you wouldn't invite me to lunch.
Right.
So, you know, you have to figure out a way to say things, and you also have to figure out a way to engage people where you're not sort of always in their face about what's not working.
Yeah.
However, I think that it really shouldn't be this hard.
Right.
And the only way that it's no longer going to be difficult, well, first of all, you know, not everybody agrees about what's best for kids.
Mm.
So you might have different opinions along the way, just on that very issue. But I think the only way it's going to get easier if more and more people basically sign up, you know, and I just mean that, you know, in the sense of learn about what's happening to kids, agree to do something about it, you know, and just be vocal about what can change.
Yeah.
Because there's no reason that we can't provide the kind of safety net we all talk about, the kind of safety net we all believe is already there.
Right.
I mean, I remember when Oprah Winfrey did an interview and was asked by her interviewer, you know, why'd she build a school in Africa? Now, you know, you can really never question why somebody wants to spend their money doing whatever it is they want to do. That's their right. And certainly there's great need across the world.
Yeah.
But what was interesting was Oprah's response, and her response was, because there's a safety net in the U.S.
Hmm.
Well, there's clearly more of a safety net in the U.S. than there is certainly in Africa.
Right.
But there are so many kids who fall through the holes in that net. And there is so much need. And there are so many more resources that we need. I mean, we look to foster families to provide what kids don't get in their birth families. And yet we ask them to do this incredibly difficult job, and we give them so little financial resources. And a lot of people believe that foster parents do it for the money, and I do not believe that that's true.
There are easier ways to make money.
There are. And the money that they get is not what it costs to raise a child.
No.
And when we expect them to not only care for these kids, but to drive them, you know, to therapy, or to, you know, to make sure they remain in their same school, or to get them the things that they need, they're not provided the kind of compensation that allows them to do those sorts of things.
Yeah,
and so at every turn in the system, we're dealing with less than is necessary to do the job.
Well, I'll tell you, amazingly, we are approaching about our time for this. One of the reasons I wanted to talk to you is because you've spoken a number of times about awareness. And one of the things I love about this format is it allows you to learn a lot about a given topic. And so, you know, I reached out to you and I said, you know, hey, you should come on the show. I want to talk about what you do. And so I'm just trying to do my part to shed more light on this wherever possible, just in my own little way. What I'm curious to know from you as we sort of wrap up, if someone's listening to this and they say, hey, I want to do something, what can they do?
Well, I mean, there's an easy answer and there's, you know, I mean, if they live right here in Colorado and they want to do something, I mean, there are a million places that they can call.
Yeah.
If they want to just talk to somebody about what they can do or find out more about what they could do, I mean, they could call the Department of Social Services. They could call any nonprofit organization that serves kids. I mean, just go online and, you know, plug in nonprofit agencies that serve kids and you'll find so many organizations that serve kids. You know, find out about your local schools and what the need might be there. You know, contact the courts. Call your legislators. I mean, there are so many places. Ask your best friend.
Yeah.
I mean, call five of your best friends and ask them what they do to donate time or talent or money to a cause.
Yeah.
You know, what are they interested in? What do they like? Ask them what event they've been to for the last event they went and partied, you know, for a nonprofit organization.
Right.
And whether they were moved by the cause. But I would also say that anybody that's listening that has an interest in learning more about the plight of abused and neglected children,
mm-hmm.
I will speak to anyone, anytime, anywhere, you know, in town, out of town, because until people really know, they can't even begin to appreciate what they might have to give to some child or some agency out there that serves kids.
It's amazing. And if people want to get in touch with you, how can they do that?
Obviously
through me. I mean, I know how
okay.
to get a hold of you, but, is there a way to contact you directly that you'd like to share?
Are you suggesting a phone number or an email?
However you want to do it is okay with me.
Okay. Sherry, Shari dot Schink, Schink 33, which stands for the 33 years I ran the law, you know,
awesome.
I was at the law center. @gmail.com.
Perfect. Well, Sherry, you are an absolute shining light in our society.
Thanks, John.
You have done absolutely tremendous work and you will continue to do it. And I am just so pleased and so privileged to get a chance to talk to you about what you do.
Thanks.
Thanks for
so
being
much.
On the show. And that will close the books on episode 39 of the John of All Trades podcast. Sherry Schink. God, what a beautiful spirit. We need more people like Sherry Schink doing good work. Society would be a much better place if there were more people like Sherry Schink and the Rocky Mountain Children's Law Center. RockyMountainChildrensLawCenter.org. If you want to get involved, that's a great place to start. Hit up Sherry via email. She gave it to you there at the end of the podcast. She would be a wonderful person to talk to and a great place to start. Thank you if you have listened to us on iTunes. Please take some time, give us a rating, give us a review. That would mean the world to me. If you're listening to us on Stitcher, thank you there as well. Rate and review us there. Help spread the word about John of All Trades. You can do that on Facebook, JOAT Pod. On Twitter, JOAT Pod. Hell, you can copy the links and email them to your friends. It does not matter to me how you do it. Just tell your friends about this. I have great podcasts coming up. We have an episode coming up on the 10th, an episode coming up on the 17th. We're going to be off for 2 weeks, and then we're off and running in January. And before I get out of here, one quick shout to our sponsor, 4Degrees. Number 4, DEGRE.ES, your one-stop shop for all your online communications needs, website building, social media, advertising, it's all there. The number 4, DEGRE.ES. I am out of here for this week. Next Monday, we'll announce the new episode. It is a good one. It's another small business owner. So, we will get out of here. I am retiring the old closing line because it's just a little bit vulgar and we got to class it up. So, say goodnight, Gracie.